Yeah, we can't voice our opinion about that particular movie because it's deeply beloved by the entire internet.
So I would be causing a stir similar to when I said I didn't like anime. Its defenders would excoriate us in the
worse.
Comments.
It would be worse.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the movie that we're talking about is called The Nirvana.
No, we're not.
Okay,
no,
okay, all right.
No. People will be so mad.
That's fascinating because, well, anyways.
Even though it is not funny.
It was bizarre. It's like walking into a conversation midway happening and you got no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
Don't even know who the two people are, but they're having like a very pronounced conversation.
Yeah, we're talking about Clerks, but moving on, we're going to talk about Iran today and the different theories of what's happening. You have something else to say for it, but I just want to say off the bat, this is my nightmare, basically, Trump doing this, you know? Like, the sort of silver lining of Trump is like, well, maybe he is an isolationist and maybe he won't do exactly this because he is always kind of threatening or thinking about doing it.
Yeah.
And now he's doing it and it's already just as bad as you'd imagine. But we'll get more into that.
Yeah, we'll get more into that. I what I had to say isn't unrelated to this issue or the other war that's happening in Europe. Wow, we've got a big war happening in Europe and one happening in Asia. When is this a world war again? When do we get to call it a world war? I don't know. Maybe this is like the Spanish Civil War portion of
you can call it whatever you want.
Yeah, I guess I'll call it a world war. But yeah, no, I don't really have anything super advanced to say except that yesterday I took MTA track card training, which is like a special certification that you have to get in order to work on the subways. And it's been one that I've wanted to get for a long time because it opens up a world of work that I've never done before. And
this would be doing TWU work or a different kind of work in conjunction with the MTA?
Work with the MTA. TWU has their own kind of maintenance of way people. It's unclear to me exactly what it is, the TW Local 100, what their jurisdiction is, but they, meaning the MTA, are constantly bringing outside contractors in, and we get hired for that work. And that work happens, of course, during the times when there's subway shutdowns. So it's a lot of weekend work and it's a lot of night work. So, you know, in my mind, it's always been attractive because if you imagine that they do a thing called general orders, which means they, like the army, right? There's like a literal memo that goes out there to all the stations that says general orders. And it basically means that they're shutting down whole sections of track or they're running one track service. We're all familiar with that.
General orders. We're skipping the stop. You think the train's coming. You're very happy and relieved. And then it just keeps going.
Yeah. General orders. Your whole commute that you had planned meticulously, it's completely fucked now.
General orders. The estimated train time is off by 4 minutes and you panic and start checking your phone, wondering if the trains are shut down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. For all of that stuff, there's the flip side of that, which is actually like the work that allegedly gets done on this shit. So this card is there as like something that was implemented in the 80s and 90s after people kept getting killed in the tunnels on the tracks as a way to kind of get everybody up to speed in terms of
safety.
Seems
like that's still happening a lot. Often when a train is delayed, I look up what's going on and it's passenger struck by train.
Yeah. Yeah. This is less passengers and more like people working. Because I guess there are some things you can do to keep like chuckleheads and chowderheads and fatheads from getting hit by trains, getting struck, like
blockheads,
civilian blockheads from getting plastered by moving train cars. But that wasn't the purpose behind this certification. It was to keep you, as you're working to like fix the tracks or the station or pour concrete, whatever the fuck it is, from getting yourself vaporized by an express train, by an N train. So it was very interesting, and maybe this is boring for people. I don't know. You don't seem to be bored by it, Andy.
Some people out there like trains.
Some people love trains. Do you love trains?
I just see it as a way to get from point A to point B.
Oh, that's very bloodless of you. I would expect nothing less. I was sitting there in this long presentation where they described in meticulous details all the many, many, many different ways the subway trains can kill you, or the tracks can kill you, or all sorts of things can kill you. And they really, in minute detail, they gave various different examples of how people were killed and how that might be you someday. So very visceral, I'll say, very like kind of a jarring presentation. And as my lovely partner, Rex, rightly pointed out, it's there to put the fear of God into you, to haze you into taking this shit seriously, which they then do with the practical part of it, where they put you in a subway tunnel and they blast a fucking train past you as you're standing in this tiny little niche to show you what it's like down there and how easily you can fuck up. What's the point of all this? I don't know if there's a point, but I was thinking to myself as like I was plunged into this world of the MTA, how different it is, how different their general orders, how different their military-like bureaucracy, how different their safety rules, and how different the kind of material reality down there in the subway is than this world that we're inhabiting more and more, which is the world of ephemera, the world of like immaterial, the world of like the Eloy and not the Morlocks. This is like
you see some Morlocks down there?
Yeah, I felt like a Morlock down there, bro. I kind of was a Morlock. We were all kind of Morlocks.
What's the twist of that again? The Morlocks are the elite, and the Eloy or the how did
so we're talking about the time machine and the right. Morlocks. It's very interesting because it's like a Victorian science fiction tale, and so class is looms large, you know, for the Victorians trying to understand. And so the Morlocks are the proletariat, and they work. There's like this incredible paradisical utopian future society where the Eloy, who are like the elves, like the wood elves or something like that, are these like beautiful creatures whose beautiful humans whose all needs are met by like mysterious technological means, and they live in a Garden of Eden, and they're half naked, and they all just kind of lounge by the pool all day or the fountain, and they eat peeled grapes and shit like that. And then below them, underneath, underground, is are the Morlocks, who are canonically in the future the proletariat, whose work is underground, whose work is keeping all the machines running, all the gears running, in order for the Eloy, the ruling class, to have this paradisical utopian lifestyle. And so it's like it's an analogy, right? It's like science fiction, because it takes certain things that are happening in the class.
Oh, yeah.
Structure.
Okay. So the twist is that it turns out the Morlocks are keeping the Eloy as food.
Oh, that is it. Yeah. That's very interesting.
Sorry for the spoiler.
No. I forgot that part of it. Like, for me, obviously, the class structure is there. But I guess it's Morlock's revenge at the end, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's his sort of like Fabian twist is like, oh, you think this is a metaphor about the cruelties of class society, but actually the upper class should be worried about this too, because they're going to eat you one day.
Right. It's like an Aldous Huxley thing, you know, because there's these two great like science fiction works that are constantly referenced in the 20th and 21st century. And that's, of course, 1984, which is George Orwell. But then, interestingly, there's Brave New World by Huxley, right? And there's two different visions there. There's like the surveillance state. There's like the Big Brother. There's endless war. There's deprivation and media manipulation.
Drugs.
Then there's Huxley, where it's
Huxley has the drugs.
Yeah. There was drugs. Oh, no, there's bad gin in 1984, which
yeah,
is a
very...
Yeah,
the are drinking gin. The funniest thing about 1984, by the way, is that the narrator is always like, well, we're fucked. Only the proles can save us.
Yeah. and then the proles...
And then he goes to the bar and the proles are just drinking gin. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, war. They're shoving pies in their mouths. Yeah.
Listening to like saccharine songs pumped out of their radios and like
very
fucking.
Relatable.
Yeah. So that was like Orwell's conception. But this is more like Huxley's like, what if... you know, what if there is paradise, but it's like, what if like human unfreedom is having everything, right? What if human unfreedom isn't you know, having a big brother surveillance state that like constantly brutalizes you and brings you into war, but instead is like a consumer society where anything you might ever want is given to you. You know, what is human freedom at the point where you know, you don't have any agency and you don't have any politics, and then things are just this sort of free floating consumer paradise. So I don't know. I don't know why I was thinking about that yesterday when I was in this track training, but I realized that running and maintaining these subways is like this generational task that like every generation has to pick up again. It's this ancient creaking machine that like needs to be constantly tended to by a group of people, by Morlocks, you know, who live under the ground. And yet, you know, above that or in the revenue trains, as they call them, on the subway platforms, millions upon millions of people rely on this work every single day, but it's not noticed or recognized. It can't be, because it's happening underground and in this weird Byzantine bureaucracy.
Yeah, not enough discussion on train stuff in general has to do with they exist to get people to work.
Right, and to play.
Yeah, but mostly to work. I mean, ridership is highest during rush hour during the week. Yeah. Well, let's stop talking about dystopian fiction and talk about what's going on in the world. Dystopian nonfiction, I guess.
I understand this is like a weird way to go about discussing the two great wars that are happening right now. But I do think it's relevant because there's like there's all sorts of spin happening right now. And it's difficult to find a platform where there isn't spin. Earlier this week, X, the Everything app, which had been decent, I guess, for like...
You might be the last person who's still calling it that. I don't even think Musk calls it that anymore.
It's a way of like denigrating the whole enterprise. I do find the whole enterprise to be increasingly ridiculous. Yeah. I'm the dead ender on that shit. But yeah, there was kind of a throttling of all of the bad news coming out of the Gulf on Elon Musk's X app. They claimed that they were trying to tamp down on disinformation and AI, even though that appears to be what AI is for, disinformation. But anyways, there's been so much spin going on, and there's been so much kind of analysis that's... emotional, and analysis that's like ephemeral and built on sort of ingrained and increasingly anachronistic notions of what power looks like and what the world looks like, that Iran is coming off like a rational actor, and the United States very much not like a rational actor. Russia and Putin, you know, these criminals, this band of criminals, claims to have a sort of like grounded geopolitical analysis, whereas Biden and Trump in the United States, it's these peons to like freedom fighters and these ephemeral sort of ideological and political notions. When I was talking to a liberal recently about the Ukraine war, they said, well, the Ukrainians have to win. They're the freedom fighters. It's like South Vietnam or, you know, or like North Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s. You know, of course, like through sheer determination and will, the little guy is going to defeat the big guy. You know, freedom will prevail at the end. And I feel like so much of our understanding, I'm saying our broadly understanding as a culture and as a society, as the West or whatever, deals in these sorts of very immaterial and ephemeral concepts of freedom and ideology and power that are just increasingly being shown to be bankrupt with the ability of actors like Russia or Iran to actually like attack the very bases of that power, you know, which is a spectacle, but is based on material power at the same time. So I don't think that those two things are completely separated. I think there's a way in which there's like an ephemeral world of empire and spectacle and power and politics that exists online, that exists in Washington, D.C. or whatever. And then there's a more gritty, grease-covered, muddy material world of like, how many drones can you produce? How much does a drone out of Iran costs versus like an interceptor in the United States, what is flowing in and out of the Straits of Hormuz, how do actors like Iran block that from happening, and what are the cascading effects on the global economy? That sort of thing is kind of being talked about more now. But for me, in my mind, that's kind of like the headline here, right, is the ability of Iran to find and utilize these choke points. And as we'll see from your various different theories that you've compiled, Trump too, it seems, maybe with Karg theory, might be looking to get a hand on those choke points as well. So behind all of this talk of freedom and democracy and theocracy and Shia versus Christians or Zog or whatever, there is like a very real and material process taking place right now, which I think bears analysis.
Yeah, and our job is to rise above it, to climb upon the train as it's moving, and surf, as it were, surf upon the train. And really, the best way to do this is to literally subway surf.
We recommend
every listener give it a shot.
There are certain scabs I'm seeing, like BMX. Famous BMXers with their advertisements on the subway that say, oh, don't subway surf. Right, you want to get home alive. Don't listen to them. They're liars.
Yeah, don't listen to
fakes.
The Rosie Perez voice announcement telling you it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Very, very few people die doing it every year.
Yeah.
Like six or seven.
Compare
that to like the hundreds who do it, you know.
Right. And, you know, have a great time with it.
And, you know, it's the best way to die, too.
It's heroic.
All right. So, yeah, like you said, I made this list of theories, and you mentioned Karg theory. The listener who's not on X, the Everything app, is missing out on everything. You probably don't know about this famous thread about the Karg theory. That people were very excited, because people are, you know, like, you're not going to find an explanation of what's going on in the Times or the Wall Street Journal, or, you know, you might get little bits and pieces, but you want to go to Twitter and find some guy,
some crank
who like works for a think tank or like wrote a book about this 14 years ago and be like, well, this sounds good enough. Maybe this is something I can like bring up in conversation.
Yeah.
So I don't have to say what literally everyone else is saying is like, I don't know.
Oh my God, this sucks. What the fuck?
When is Trump going to stop? This is scary.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to live my life here.
The subway car. I'm on top of the train and it's entering the station.
I just want a subway surf, man. I don't need this shit.
Oof.
Killing my vibes. Yeah. Karg theory is this idea that there's an island called Karg off the coast of Iran where they handle 90% of their... There's oil facilities. I don't know if it's refinement. It seems like it's more oil storage, and that's where they ship out a lot of the oil.
It's a transshipment point, as I understand it. So, like, a lot of the pipes, and I'm not sure how much refinement they do there. A lot of the raw crude just kind of ends up pumped to this island where I think there's facilities to fill up oil tankers and gas tankers. It's both natural gas and oil. The distinction between those two things, I think, will become more important in coming weeks. But yeah, Karg is like a central node in their transshipment of oil and gas, especially to places like China.
It's a little island. It's about half the size of Manhattan. And so the theory that this guy, whose name is Guy Laren, puts out, is that Trump's goal with this whole thing is to seize Karg, continue oil production as normal, continue funding the Revolutionary Guard with this oil, but just have it under his auspices like Venezuela. So this is sort of like the Venezuela theory too. And the evidence that they've set for this is some unnamed officials who claim that they've given this theory up to the higher echelons, and even they admit that they have no idea if they've read it or know about Karg.
Sure.
But they think was posted on early Saturday. They think that they saw this playing out with the attempt to move Navy in that direction and then claim that the Kurds were invading from the north, from the Iraqi border,
as a distraction,
as a way to get Iranian troops to move in that direction, and then in combination with bombing in the south, be able to seize Karg and Kargify the country. Now, He links an article from EE News, which is like an energy vertical of Politico. And interestingly, CARG has a long history in this, you know, this long conflict between Iran and the United States. During the 1979 Iran hostage crisis, Carter actually advised seizing CARG to provide leverage against the regime. He chose not to, and then when Reagan comes in, he destroyed other offshore export facilities in the 1980s. Iran mined the Straits of Hormuz, but CARG was left untouched because they're woke. Now we're not woke. Now we're not afraid to touch CARG anymore.
To peace heads, we're not afraid to molest the money or touch the CARG.
And then a little bit later, during the Iran-Iraq war, Iraq partially destroyed CARG, but Iran quickly rebuilt it.
It's hard to keep a good CARG down.
And so this EE News article ends by saying, American-Israeli forces have tried to avoid striking Iran's oil infrastructure, according to a former Trump energy advisor who was granted anonymity. He says, quote, as long as Iran has the ability to get oil out, it's not going to try to take that ability away from anyone else because it knows that once it does that, its oil infrastructure will get destroyed. It's a sort of mutually assured destruction, so nobody will do anything. Oh, that's nice.
Oh.
Later that night, that's exactly what happened.
And then we also bombed their desalinization plant, which is an incredible escalation.
So
too.
I'm going to rule out CARG theory.
CARG theory. You're a disbeliever.
Because... Or I mean, maybe that was something that was in the cards, like early. Maybe Trump thought
in
like
the CARGs.
An early, yeah, let's CARG it up, yeah. But it didn't work out. And Israel yesterday bombed oil containers and apparently refinement facilities outside of Tehran. And Iran responded by attacking oil infrastructure around the Middle East, including in Haifa in Israel.
That mutually assured
destruction appears to be well underway. So, you know, maybe CARG will have that's still a CARG that will be played, but not exactly as EE News and Guy Laren pointed it out. So,
well, you know, there is a chance still that the U.S. military will put on its cargo pants and take the island for leverage, because there's something about this theory, I think, that's very attractive, because it would establish a pattern. It would, if you combine this with Venezuela and the way in which there was no regime change, instead the Trump administration found people they could deal with inside the existing Venezuelan state and kind of lop the head off. Maybe the difference that we see is that the United States doesn't have a mad dog like Israel in Latin America. I guess Argentina hasn't yet begun to play that role. And so it feels like...
They've got a bad history of trying to seize small islands.
Yeah, true.
Although maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe soon.
So it establishes a, what we could say, a pattern, the CARG theory, which is that Trump, as a businessman and now as a president, is trying to establish some sort of leverage over an existing regime, not to... nation building or democracy promotion or any of that woke nonsense, but instead just finding these pressure points, grabbing them, and then using them to bend a particular state to his will. So that is
and via that Russia and China as well, because I think a lot of I've heard a lot of sort of left takes saying that China's fine without Iranian oil because it's only like 5 to 10% of the oil that they buy, but obviously Putin and China are very concerned about what's happening in Iran for various reasons. Oil is certainly one of them. So taking Iran out as this sort of pressure point in the balance of the oil production along with Venezuela would be very advantageous to whatever kind of U.S. like restoring U.S. dominance over the New World Order.
Right, and now so what CARG theory also does is it moves us away from like Zog theory or so something that we've made fun of rightfully a lot on this show, which is that, you know, this is merely a play for Jewish dominance over the Middle East or whatever. To the extent to which that as a factor, I think, is an open one. But like seeing this as instead an intervention in superpower rivalry between China and the United States, seeing all of the various different military means that Trump has used, from Venezuela to Cuba, now on to Iran and I guess presumably elsewhere, as kind of gambits in this larger geopolitical battle, this geopolitical war between a rising empire and a falling one. This puts us on territory that I think is much more grounded, maybe much more Morlock as opposed to Eloy. And that's maybe one of the attractions of Karg theory. That said, and this is not exclusive to Karg theory, I think we need to open the possibility that any theory that we present, similar to the unnamed sources in this article and similar to what you said, Andy, any theories that we proffer might be running up against a reality, which is that Trump as a businessman and now as a world-spanning...
He's being blackmailed by Benjamin Netanyahu and he's been hypnotized and blackmailed.
Yeah, by the Jews.
He was blackmailed and then hypnotized. And he can't say no to whatever Netanyahu says. And Lindsey Graham went to Israel and got secret words to say to Trump to convince him to do this.
He said abracadabra.
And Tucker Carlson, who we like now because he hates Israel too,
right,
was trying to talk him out of it, but he was simply too enthralled by Netanyahu.
Thank you for, let me finish my point. Thank you for bringing up, I think, what I want to critique, which is this tendency of analysis that you so lovingly lampooned just now, right? Like maybe to imagine that there's one theory of power, that Trump's trying to do one thing, or that he's already settled for himself on like an ideal way that this is going to shake out, is maybe the wrong way to look at it. And instead, this is a businessman negotiating with Iran when he has force of arms behind him, the most powerful military in world history, but also all the various different theories that Trump himself and his people have proffered for why this is a good move. Presenting it to the American people is also a negotiation. It's a moving target. In fact, there's like what Trump has done is in this case and many others is open up a space of negotiation and used very classic forms in his mind of leverage in order to kind of open up a negotiating space. And so maybe what we're seeing right now isn't war as politics by other means, but war as business negotiation by other means. And that's why it seems so confusing to all of us as the public, because as a public, we're not used to dealing with things in these terms. We're used to Colin Powell and George Bush and Condoleezza Rice telling us exactly the lies that they want us to hear to convince us of their ultimate objective. Maybe Trump doesn't have ultimate objectives and maybe doesn't feel the need to even lie as much as other people did, because we're not part of this process. We are part of the negotiation too. He's negotiating with us what we'll put up with and what we'll deal with for his dreams of empire.
Yeah, but maybe we can get to that at the end. It's like, where do we come into it? Maybe we can like sort of go through the theories first and work our way there.
Yeah.
Right. So I just to wrap up the Zog Epstein theory, which is, you know, both that like the Israel's blackmailed the U.S. government. The U.S. government works for Israel.
Right.
Now, Trump like does Netanyahu's laundry and like pulls the seat out for him.
The tails wagging the dog.
Or the softer version of that, which is that this is all to distract from the Epstein files. Sure. Not that there's like no basis of truth in any of these narratives. You know, there's obviously, you know, like we are seeing really crazy Epstein revelations coming out like in the midst of this war. Yeah. Like it seems pretty clear now that there are credible accusations against Trump of raping children and
violence against
Epstein was murdered. And that's sort of coming out now. But regardless, this, I think, is the most prominent theory.
Yeah,
I think this is like the popular theory. Yeah. I really don't believe that like the entirety of the U.S. government, especially the Trump administration, is willing to just be subservient to Israel. I think they are they do see their own interests in this somewhere. And it's not like, fuck America, we like Israel more, or like, we have no choice, we have to do what Israel tells us. Right. I don't think that is a plausible explanation. And I also don't think Trump cares much about the Epstein stuff. Like, he's already been on trial for rape, like it was a civil trial, and also in the public, and his attitude publicly has been to deny in an official capacity, but then also to brag about it more or less openly otherwise. Right. So I don't think he really cares about that stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't think he sees himself as an agent of Israel. I don't believe that. I think he sees what he's doing as good for the country and himself, which, you know, in his mind are the same thing.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that there are things in the files that are an embarrassment for Trump. And I think maybe that explains why there was a slow walking of getting this out. I do believe that he it was reported to him what was in the files, all sorts of allegations against him, and that was part of why they were slow walked in their release, why it took an act of Congress to do something about it. But if people had a really good time a couple few weeks ago going through those files and reading salacious allegations by witnesses, by people who allege that he did all sorts of criminal acts, and those may or may not be true, but they ultimately were not enough for the Biden administration to bring charges against Trump or any of his people, nor was it enough during the first Trump administration for him to bring charges against political enemies like the Clintons or Biden or other people.
Apparently enough to kill him. But
Epstein, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he was a organized crime figure. So there's a lot of reasons to kill him. There's a lot of people that might want to kill him for a lot of different reasons.
You know, who had the power to do it?
Oh, sure.
The Trump administration.
Yeah,
specifically sure. William Barr. But let's move on to the next theory. This is, I think, maybe more what I'm leaning towards at the moment, just from like the news of the past 24 hours, which is what I like to call make total destroy, which is that mutually assured destruction that we talked about, that this unnamed Trump official said will not happen. Now that that's happened, I wonder if the point of going after Iran wasn't, or maybe it was initially to like Venezuelize it, but having failed that and making it seem like, oh no, Iran will put up a fight, as Trump said. Maybe now the game is to just reduce the total influence that the Middle East has in terms of oil production and economic production, which is obviously going to be an incredibly chaotic and costly process, causing not only like, you know, the rise of oil prices, but also disrupting really important supply chains of different byproducts of oil and shipping, you know, including helium and
fertilizer,
right? Urea for fertilizer.
Yeah.
And so we're already seeing the destruction of oil production facilities with bombs. Even before that, we were seeing oil production shutting down in places like Iraq. And shutting down oil is not just a temporary thing. You know, when those processes stop, it degrades the machinery and the general process in general, and it's hard to recover it. It damages actually the entire output of the process. And we're just seeing that obviously, you know, the damage is being multiplied by like physical damage by, you know, like refineries and storage being physically destroyed all across the Middle East. So why would they maybe want to start that process? Why are they going to that mutual assured destruction? Well, perhaps it's because the United States now has their own sort of oil monopoly in the West, in Venezuela and in the US.
Fracking, yeah.
And so like the destruction of what's considered the best kind of oil coming from the Middle East maybe increases the viability of this heavy crude in Venezuela.
Sure.
And makes the United States far more powerful as like the guarantor of oil production.
Okay, so this is like a the sort of theories that were floating around in the early 2000s about how the war in Iraq was because Dick Cheney served on the board of Halliburton, and there was Kellogg, Brown, and Root, and that these groups would like profiteer off of this shit. So really what the United States, under this anti-CARG theory, I would call it, is trying to do, as this theory posits, is wreck other forms of oil so that American and American-controlled oil in Venezuela can have preponderance over the rest. That's an interesting, I don't buy it, but you know, it's an interesting way to go about this sort of thing. It's a, it ignores, I think, but maybe Trump is ignoring the effects that oil prices are going to have on the American and global economy. But it's interesting. What do you think about the theory?
Well, yeah, it's really hard to imagine they would be that crazy.
Yeah.
But we are seeing it happen. And like, with this goal of total surrender from Iran, like there's no way through that besides them mining the Strait of Hormuz, which will make it, well, you know, like we're at a moment right now where like ships are sort of waiting to get through.
Yeah.
And Trump was saying like, oh, well, we'll escort the ships, which is
that ain't happening.
Not very plausible either. But if they mine the Strait, that's going to take a very long time, to clear. And so the strategically that the direction they're pointing in is making the, all of the production that goes on through the Strait, and on the mainland, not possible anymore. And they're not, it doesn't seem like they're trying to avoid that, which is what these Trump officials were saying was they were going to do. And now they're not. So, there's a part of this, I guess this plays into the Zog theory to some extent where like Israel has its own goals in this, which is to like just turn the entire Middle East into Syria,
leaving Israel
the only stable actor standing, Israel and Turkey, I guess.
And so there's an extension of that, and the United States is then acting alongside Israel with the intention of making the United States and its orbit like the only oil producers, right, in the world, not even in the region, but to knock. See that I find that kind of implausible as well. You know, not just the Zog aspect of it, although I do think Israel has its own reasons for this war, obviously, right? And I think some of those are at cross purposes actually with what Trump and his administration would recognize as like American interest, right? But I feel like they're riding the tiger at this point. One advantage that this theory has, and again, I'm being very neutral in all of this, is that it goes some way towards explaining one of the very real unexplainables of all of this. And I'm sure you've noticed this too, Andy, is that leading up to this this war, let's call it what it is, which started about 7-8 days ago, Iran, the Iranian leadership, the Islamic Republic, Republic of Iran, was very clear that they were going to wreck the region. They were going to very quickly turn this into a regional war and shut down the Straits of Hormuz and make it economically and politically painful for the United States if they chose to attack. And this was all choreographed, you know, for weeks out. And you had anybody who had been paying attention to this, which includes me and presumably you and many of the listeners, could see that the reaction to this, to an attack on, say, the Ayatollah, wasn't going to be a pulled punch as previous American strikes were, that Iran was going to blow up the whole region. And they were very clear about that. And yet, of course, Trump does it anyways, which is one of these great mysteries, right? It's like, is he getting bad intel? You know, is this the sidelining of Tulsi Gabbard? Is this sidelining of various different advisors and CIA analysts within the administration? Maybe something similar to what we saw with the cooked intelligence to the lead up of the war in Iraq. Is Trump getting bad information from his people? You know, is he ignorant of all this? What this theory that you posit, this anti-CARGist theory, is that they knew the consequences, and in fact they're now using the Iranian response as a play in order to you know, get various different economic and geopolitical things done that they wanted to get done anyway, i.e. increase the preponderance of American control over world oil production. So at least it has that benefit. And I'm not sure if I buy the theory, but it at least has the benefit of explaining, I think, this kind of glaring contradiction at the heart of this whole enterprise. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Here's another theory. That Trump is a neo-conservative. And okay. This is, I
the
guess...
The more neos you put,
we
the
could
more...
All, we could also maybe call it, like, white knight theory or, like, even humanitarian Trump theory. Because the neoconservative were not actually... I mean, I think they were a bit more idealistic than people give them credit for.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just about, you know, expanding American empire, which is what I think Trump and Rubio are interested in. It's about it was about spreading democracy.
Yes.
Like, I think they actually believe that to some extent.
I think they did, too.
It wasn't just a talking point. I mean, we're very critical of their conception of democracy, of course.
Yeah.
And obviously how it played out, even within the bounds of that conception. But I have heard some people, even a leader of a very prominent up-and-coming socialist party, claiming that Trump's... motivations here was because he really didn't like the way Iran was killing protesters earlier this year. And so he wanted to step in and actually defend the Iranian people and free them from this tyrannical regime.
And that, of course, opens up a whole other can of worms because truly the number of Iranian protesters, and I don't like to litigate these things because we have no way of knowing, but I will point out that the number rose from like 2 to 5 to 30 to 60 to 80,000 protesters killed within a couple of days very quickly.
The media is generally saying 30,000, and I think it's undoubtedly in the thousands, but and no one really knows, but I would say it's probably in the low thousands, but it's still
horrifying. Lot of people.
It's a lot of people in a very short amount of time. It is a very brutal regime, and they did kill a lot of protesters.
And that's why I don't want to litigate it, because I think that's true, what you say, fundamentally true. And I think that the numbers thrown out there and the inflation of those numbers shouldn't make us think, oh, the whole thing is fake. Instead, this might be another one of those cases where Trump is being spun, you know, but maybe not. Maybe, as you say, there's a sort of neo-conservative rationale to this entire thing, that fundamentally Trump has what many people critiqued 20 years ago, and might actually be a reactionary critique even on the left, but that like the neoconservatives were naive because the Iraqis were like incapable of democracy and self-governance, and that the neocons going in didn't realize that when you break it, you buy it, and that I guess the secularized materialist version of this is that Iraqis have faced so much oppression for so long and the borders are fake due to Sykes-Picot or whatever, that democracy was never going to happen in the Middle East, which is a very pessimistic way to understand the world.
And it's historically ridiculous.
It's historically ridiculous. So Trump then is responding to failures of the past by creating new failures, which is, I guess, what American presidents do nowadays, right? I do think that this theory here matches with something that I've argued before, which is that, Trump is fundamentally, again, like about leverage and about making deals. And the reason why he thought the war in Iraq and the war and the pullout of Afghanistan, the reason why he opposed these things, both the war and the pullout, because they were done in a stupid way, because Obama was stupid, because Biden was stupid, because Bush was stupid, fundamentally, right? It was less about, the general anti-regime change stuff that in his second term he started talking about more. And it was more about like, only I can do it. Right. Only I can go into the Middle East and use leverage because of my long experience on The Apprentice and as a real estate developer to actually do the things that Bush and Obama wanted to do, but not in a stupid way, in a smart way. Cheap, easy, fast, boom, in, out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm partial to the idea that Biden's pullout from Afghanistan, which is one of the best things he did, by the way, was Trump's plan. Trump did have this time frame when he went out of office, and so Trump kind of had the benefit there of like making the plan but then getting to blame Biden for how it played out, and he's been kind of savvy in that regard of like, he doesn't have to deal with the consequences of right. what he does, but that's no longer the case. Like yeah. there people will, unless they double down and triple down on Zog theory, they will, which I think is what like Tucker and JD Vance are trying to do. This will be considered Trump's war, and the absolute disaster that we're going to see, you know, in weeks to come, in months to come, in years to come, will be blamed on Trump without a doubt.
Yeah. And, I don't know if this is the time to bring up this drop site article, I think, that you shared with me about. This was in the lead up to the war in
Oh,
Iran,
yes. Very
about,
good.
About the Democrats yeah. and about, let's say, the ambiguity of our quote unquote opposition party when it comes to all sorts of regime change actions against Iran in the Middle East, especially Chuck Schumer, because people might have recognized that this last week, both the Senate and the House of this August constitutional republic of ours voted down a war powers resolution that was built, designed to stop this illegal war of aggression, quote unquote. And I only put those in quotes because I don't think international law really means anything anymore. And I'm not sure the Constitution does either. But anyways, this War Powers Act was supposed to actually intervene in a real way and pull back the American response, stop the American aggression. And it failed. Predictably, it failed. And it failed in a way that, like Charlie Brown, you know, having the football pulled back from him once again, outraged all sorts of progressives, people on the left here in the United States who haven't given up completely on this sort of.
Yeah,
Democrat.
They're Charlie Brown.
They are. Yeah.
Chuck Schumer is Lucy.
You think?
Yeah.
Pulling, okay. pulling the football away. Absolutely. Yeah.
So
yeah,
here's
yeah.
the
it took this, me a second,
this,
but yes, that's
this
right.
This was, and like, we all know this. We all know the Democrats want this war. They're more or less saying it. But this was kind of a smoking gun in this whole thing that I, you know, I really commend DropSite via Ryan Grimm for coming up with. In June 2025, at the same time Trump was floating the possibility of a strike against Iran, he spoke positively about encouraging progress in ongoing nuclear talks, suggesting that if a deal was met, those strikes would be off. Schumer responded by mocking the president as Taco Trump, uh-huh. using an acronym for Trump always chickens out.
Right.
For opponents of war with Iran, Schumer's taunt was counterproductive, and a coalition of more than two dozen organizations sent a letter urging Schumer to delete the video and give Trump political space to reach a diplomatic solution. These were groups like Brooklyn for Peace and, you know, like it was like New York anti-war groups right. that Schumer actually followed up with. So the letter led to a phone call between one of the letter's organizers and the top foreign policy aide to Schumer, who laid out the thinking of many Democrats in the Senate. A congressional source briefed on the call shortly afterwards confirmed the details. The foreign policy aide, whom DropSite agreed not to name, explained that a substantial number of Senate Democrats believed Iran is ultimately needed to be dealt with militarily. But those Democrats, the aide explained, also understood that going to war against again in the Middle East would be a political catastrophe. That's precisely why they wanted Trump to be the one to do it. The hope was that Iran would take a blow and so would Trump. A win-win for Democrats.
Win-win-win.
This is Schumer's office telling this
yeah.
to the anti-war groups, telling this to the base.
Yeah, sure.
The anti-war base of the Democratic Party, stupidly in a way of trying to defend Schumer. It's like, oh no, Schumer's doing this Taco Trump thing. He doesn't really want the war, but the rest of the Democratic Party does. And so he's very savvily trying to goad Trump into war so the Democrats get what they want and Trump takes the consequences of it, which I think is absolutely what we're seeing.
Yeah. And it's actually, it's a nice example, as you say, because it's really what the promise is for progressives, which is like what his advisors are saying to the progressive base is, don't worry, we're managing you. Don't worry, you're being managed right now. And isn't that ultimately like all the progressives want from the Democrats, is to be managed, is to be like taken seriously enough that their interests can be discarded, you know, but their interests are recognized. And then it's like, oh yeah, yeah, we totally know what you mean, but don't worry, we're ahead of it. We're making sure that you have no power and nothing to do about the entire thing while we're pretending to listen to you. So it's great, because if you look at the subsequent to this article, the War Powers resolution, both in the House and the Senate, once again, it squeaked by with nearly unanimous Democratic Party support for this War Powers resolution, but only four Democrats in the House breaking with the leadership. Of course, those four would have been enough to break to go for the resolution, so it would have passed. And of course, these are four Democrats who sit in very safe seats in Congress. And so this whole vote was stage managed in such a way that it would barely not pass, right? So that the Democrats would be able to express their interest, but say there isn't actually anything we can do about this because we don't have the votes for it. For people who live in New York and people outside of New York, Andy, you might remember this. Do you remember the Independent Democrats caucus under Cuomo?
Right.
What it did? For people who don't know, it was basically like a breakaway because the Democrats had a supermajority up in Albany. It was a breakaway caucus of like centrist Democrats who would often be the deciding factor, deciding vote in getting progressive things shot down in Albany. Well, it turns out after, you know, many, many years of this chicanery up in Albany where Cuomo would not have to veto progressive things because they would never come up to his desk for signing it. It turns out that the Democratic leadership in Albany and Cuomo himself controlled this splinter group the entire fucking time. And the entire reason that it existed was to ensure that the progressives within New York, who were a powerful caucus, were being managed in such a way that they couldn't intercede, that it would all be ephemeral, it would be Eloy shit, and you would never have a Morlock situation where, you know, real things
actually
happen.
Well, the story gets worse than that, because in 2018, of course, there's this huge blue wave, and the progressives, the independent Democrats actually gave the Republicans the majority in the state Senate. And like you said, it was sort of an excuse to like keep progressivism off the table. When the blue wave comes in, these DSA type candidates are able to like push this progressive legislation that was long not allowed to come to a vote. And still, you know, to a much lesser degree, but still, you had Democrats reversing on some of that stuff because it wasn't just like, you know, Cuomo was kind of like the bad guy, and the IDC could be the bad guy in this. But really, a lot of the Democrats aren't trying to push this progressive legislation. But let's try to, you know, challenge ourselves again to surf above this level of like, oh, we hate the Democrats, they're full of shit or whatever. Like, why is it that the Democrats want the war with Iran? I think this really gets to the heart of the matter, because I think that to an extent, the Democrats are playing controlled opposition because they support Trump. They see Trump as a way to like push forward, like in a Bonapartist fashion, these long stalled projects that was the policy of Biden and Obama: regime change in Iran, regime change in Venezuela. They just wanted to do it slowly, and Trump comes in, he's like, fuck it, I'll do it now. Let's be legends. Why are we just starving the Iranian people over the course of decades?
Right.
Why don't we just take away the oil and the water and bomb the fuck out of them until they wave the white flag?
Right. So Democrats are like, they found their Leroy Jenkins in Donald Trump.
But why?
You know, I think that's right. I think that there is a lot of basis for that theory. And I think that this is evidenced by their political calculus, which seems to be that they'll let Trump hang himself by a petard that Trump thought was hanging for others. Oh, no, we're going to hang Trump by his own petard. That'll show him. And then in the midterms, we win. And then we get Reichsführer Gavin Newsom to be president in 3 years. And then
he can democratize Iran.
Exactly. Then it's our time to shine, and we can take the wreckage, this wreckage that Trump has done. We can take Democratic Party control over Karg Island. And use that leverage for good things like Obama would want, not bad things like Bush or Trump would want. Good things like Biden was trying to do, right? Because, yes, I think fundamentally there's a way in which thanks for listening, everybody. If you like what you heard and you want to hear more of it, if you want to get all of our great bonus content, all sorts of specials that we run, access to our Discord server or whatever, become supporters of our podcast at patreon.com/thiswreckage. Tons of great bonus going back years. So do become a supporter of our enterprise. We would appreciate it very much.
And we always appreciate if you sign up at the annual level. You get a discount when you do that. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.